You're listening to the official podcast of Asbury University, produced by students with God-honoring conversations that inform, edify, and encourage. This is Asbury. We explore culture and current topics through a Christian worldview, promoting a well-balanced life, and we empower our community to belong, become, and be set apart. I'm your host, Abby Laub. Welcome to This is Asbury.
Today, I'm excited to welcome Dr. Ryan Burge. Dr. Burge is a political scientist with Eastern Illinois University, but he's also one of the foremost statisticians in the country on evangelicalism, religiosity, and politics. And so he is our search speaker, and I'm excited to have him in the studio today. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. President. Glad to be here.
You are a name that comes up a lot in Christian circles. Can you just provide a quick bio of your professional and personal life? What do you want people to know about you, what you do, and why you do it?
I have a PhD in political science from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I am teaching at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. I've been there for about 12 years now. I just got tenure last year, so this is where you say congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, yes. Yeah. Everyone's like, what do I say here? Thank you. I started on Twitter probably in 2017-18 and really kind of built up a following there of just tweeting graphs about topics, religion and politics topics, and slowly went from having no followers to having more than no followers. And that led to all kinds of interesting opportunities. You know, Christianity Today asked me if I would write for them, and then Religion News Service, and then it got to the next level of like New York Times and Politico and all that stuff. Then I wrote a book called The Nuns, Where They Came From, Who They Are, Where They're Going, with Fortress. And that came out in 21. And then 20 Myths About Religion and Politics came out in 22. Then the book The Nuns Version 2 came out, and a book called The Great Dechurching, which I wrote with Michael Graham and Jim Davis. And last year, like a year ago yesterday, I started a Substack called GraphsAboutReligion.com, where I write two posts a week about religion, politics, and data about what's going on in American religion. And so I've also been a pastor in the American Baptist Church, and I've served the American Baptist Church for over 20 years now, both as a youth pastor and a pastor. I'm married. My wife and I have been married for 17 years now, and we have two sons who are 12 and 9.
So you write a lot. You do a lot of research. You're a very quotable guy, and you've made this fascinating statement. I've come to realize that the way that most people think about religion and politics is only loosely linked to any empirical reality. Can you elaborate on that quote?
I think the problem is that we only hear little anecdotes and drips and drabs of information here and there, and then we try to piece it together in a cohesive whole in our minds. And the reality is way more complicated than that. And the one thing I would point to most especially is people, when I say, are you religious? I think the average person says they automatically go to a belief metric. Like, what do you believe, like Jesus, the Bible, or God, or Buddha, or Muhammad, or whatever? And what's funny from a social science perspective is that's probably the least consequential thing about you when it comes to religion. I'm much more interested in if you say you're evangelical or not, or if you attend church or a house of worship every week. From a political perspective, those two factors are actually much more indicative and predictive of how you vote and how you behave politically than what you believe. So I think the way that we think about religion is what do you believe? And I think about religion in terms of what do you behave, or how do you behave? Where do you go? How often you go? And then who do you belong to? Like, let's say I'm a Catholic. I was raised Catholic, but I haven't been to Mass in 15 years. On a survey, if I ask you what's your present religion of any, if you say you're Catholic and then tell me you never go to church, like, what does that mean? Like, what are you trying to tell me? Mm-hmm. And I think those are the kind of interesting questions that when I think about religion, that the more you dig into it, it's like an onion. The more you dig into it, the more layers there are behind everything else. And it gives you a more accurate picture of what's going on in the world. Like, I always tell people, like, imagine people like, oh, polls are bad. I go, okay, let's get rid of them. Do you think we understand the world better or worse without polls? You can't tell me we understand the world better without polls. Are they perfect? No. Are they good? Sometimes. But how are we going to see what the world looked like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, objectively, as objectively as we can? Because no one can do that personally, because we all live in our own little bubbles. Polling gets us further back from that. And I think that's the real value. It helps us track things over time. So it gives me a more objective view of the world. And I tell people, it's not my job to tell you how the world is. Or it's my job to tell you how the world is, not how I wish it to be or hope it to be.
Right.
Just to describe what it looks like. And if that makes you mad, okay. If it makes you happy, okay. I really don't care, because my job is just to tell you the truth.
Yes. Well said. You mentioned the great de-churching. That was a fantastic book. I'm happy to hear some more content will come out related to that work. The data reveals some very concerning trends regarding U.S. church attendance over the last 25 years. Can you just give a sketch of some of the bad news?
There's a lot. Yeah. So about 40 million people have joined the never attending camp just between 2008 and 2022. Went from 35 million to 75 million between 2008 and 2022. The share of Americans who never attend is now higher than the share of Americans who attend once a week or more. That happened in the last 5 years or so. Kind of one of those things that we never really know. There was no like moment on television where that, you know, we talked about that.
Right.
But it happened. We've lost, like I said, 40 million people. And in the book, we make the claim that if you add all the people who converted to Christianity in the First Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening and all the Billy Graham Crusades in the United States combined, it's less than 40 million people. So all the gains that religion made in America, those three very consequential religious events, have all been negated by this great de-churching that's happened in America in just the last 15 years.
Yeah, what was fascinating to me was, and I'm playing off of some of the language you and the other authors use, is about 75%, 25% of those leaving 10 million roughly could be a casualty exit, so mm-hmm. church hurt. Hypocrisy, abuse, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But the 75% was more of a casual exit.
That's, to me, that's the big contribution that the book makes to the discourse. Because the discourse you see online is traditionally, Trump led me out of church, or I was gay and I couldn't go to church, or, you know, I was a single parent, or they had these like sort of like major life events and they had a moment where they like, had an epiphany. They're like, I'm gone, I'm leaving. And it's all about always about theology or politics or gender or sexuality, something big like that. And there are people who do leave church for that. Like there's no doubt. And like you said, about 25% of people who de-church did for those reasons. But the vast majority, it wasn't that. It was more of, well, I used to go, you know, 15 times a year, then I went 10 times a year, then I went 5 times a year, then I haven't been in 5 years. It's a slow and steady slide, and it's not really based on theology or politics or any sort of major, you know, it's things like I moved. I mean, that's the real stunning finding from the book is moving, getting married, changing jobs, like major life events.
Sports.
Yes, sports. It's casual de-churching. It's not like they're anti-religion. Right, that's the key thing here. They're just kind of ambivalent about religion. I think the thing that demands reflection from the religious community is this: when people left, why did they not feel a void in their life and feel like they needed to come back? Mm-hmm. You know, because the theory is, if you leave religion, you're gonna leave a piece of you behind. You're gonna be missing. There's a God-shaped hole in you, like Blaise Pascal said. But apparently it doesn't look that way, at least for the vast majority of people who leave religion. They don't feel this yearning, this open gaping wound that needs to be healed. And the question is, so what is church not doing that's making it so easy to leave and not come back?
Yeah, you mentioned reflection. Just interpreting that, would it be fair to say that a casual exit that large is in some way, maybe directly, a function of a casual Christianity?
Oh, I think we've always misconceptualized Christianity, and that there was a point in American history where there were a lot of very fervent believers. Like most of Americans were like going to church twice a week and biblical literalists and all those things. And if you look back at history, I actually have a textbook that is through Oxford. And one chapter, it's called The American Religious Landscape, Facts, Trends, and the Future. And the first chapter is tracing American religion from the colonial period to today, where I look at data from the 1760s and 1770s, like church membership records. And, you know, if you look at New England, like 12% of New Englanders were part of a church in the colonial period. More women had babies less than 9 months after they got married than were members of a church in those days. Like, we were never as religious as we thought we were. The kind of religious we were was always culturally religious. So it's not like we weren't all pilgrims in the 1780s, 1790s. Most people were sort of ambivalent about religion. And guess what? Today, most people are still pretty ambivalent about religion. There's your hardcore people who are opposed, and you're very religious people, and there's a whole bunch of people in the middle. America has generally always looked like that. I think we've just been better at diagnosing the problem and assessing the size of it today than we have been because of the advancement in research methods. So I don't know if I call it the great revealing. You know, we're just revealing what's always been below the surface. We just couldn't see because our methodology wasn't good enough.
So that's the bad news.
Yeah.
But the book had some good news.
Yeah. There's some good. I'll give you. I always like whenever I do one of these talks, like, well, man, I'm depressed. Give me some good some good data points to make me less depressed. The answer is that lots and lots of people who have de-churched are open to the idea of coming back.
Yeah.
And there's the big common theme is like, what would bring me back? If you look at the thread that runs through that, friends is really the constant theme. You know, it's not like I had an epiphany from God or something like that. It's almost always like I would go if my friends went, or I would go there to find new friends. It's about friends. Mm-hmm. I think we think a lot in America that about religion being a theological thing, being a vertical thing. But if you look, if you listen to what the de-church people are telling us, is they don't see the primary reason for coming back a theological thing. It's not like I want to go back to church so I, when I die, I go to heaven. That is not what they say. They say they want to come back because that's where their friends are. They want to make new friends. They want to, you know, find a support network. And so I think churches need to think very carefully and strategically about emphasizing the horizontal aspect of their gathering and the value that people get from just being in a social space with other people. And I think, honestly, that's actually really good news because it's easier to convince people of that argument than that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and died and was resurrected for your sins. It's easier to say, hey, if you come here, it's easier to get friends.
Yes.
You know, because they can see that. That's tangible. And they're going to have immediate payback, right? As soon as they go for a week or two, they're like, oh, wow, look at all these people. So I think in some ways it's actually the most hopeful thing because the mechanism to get them back is not like, oh, here's a 12-year plan to get people back in church. No, it's like they come for three Sundays, they find friends, and they stay there forever.
Yes. Yeah, this last Sunday there was a family in our church. They are being commissioned. They are going to take a church in Washington. It's a family from Africa. But they were sharing their story, and what struck me was how just like prosaic it was to get them there. They met someone. They said, we don't have a church. And they said, well, I will drive you into Lexington, Kentucky to go to this church. And that was that. It was as simple as that. But then once they got there, they met other people. They're kind of woven in to a thickly constituted community. And 9 years later, they're on this trajectory to ministry. And so it's interesting to think about strategic plans or big conferences, but maybe the answers are more simplistic. That doesn't mean they're easy, but they're more clear than we might think.
When I was in grad school, we did a whole week on what causes people to vote, which is like the most democratic question in the world, right? Like what what makes you want to go vote? And there was a whole book written in 1996 by Rosenstone and Hansen, and I could summarize the entire thesis of the book. People vote because they were asked to vote. Like, that's literally the thing that turns you from not voter to voter. And you see politicians do this, by the way. Can I count on you for a vote? Like, they want to ask you personally. Like, why do people not go to church? Big answer is because no one asked them to go to church. Like, make it easy to get there, and they will go there. And the problem is, though, you've got to convince them of the value of a long-term commitment to an institution.
Right.
That's the harder lift today. Which is that everyone wants to kind of go do their own thing, right? Like be at home and watch Netflix and not go out and be a hermit and be an introvert. Like I feel like we're in a time where introverts are like, yay, this is our time to shine. But we know that human beings are social animals. Mm-hmm. Like the Geneva the United Nations says that putting people in isolation for long periods of time is a form of torture now and should be considered a war crime. Because we realize that it will psychologically change you for the rest of your life if you're in isolation for a year or 2 years. We are doing that to ourselves in small ways every day and going, why are we so anxious? Right. Why are we so upset? It's because you were meant to be in community. And we're not getting that. A lot of homes are all wherever they are. A lot of workplaces are remote now or hybrid, so you're not even with those people very much. And we don't have a third space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, church used to be one of those third spaces, but also the Kiwanis and the Boy Scouts. And, you go on the bowling league, you go on the list. All those things that used to be robust institutions in American life have disappeared what's going to replace that? I think religion is one of the very last vestiges of that third space that we've created. And unfortunately, it's crumbling day by day, but it could be one of the last things that redeems us from, you know, a social perspective.
Yes, well said. So Asbury is in the business of student formation. We work with this generation, Gen Z, to provide an intellectually rigorous and spiritually formative experience. And Gen Z is often pathologized as a generation. I mean, maybe they all are. I'm coming to recognize Gen X. Here's everything wrong with Gen X. But they do constitute a large percentage of those who are not religiously affiliated, mm-hmm. obviously what you've studied. Mm-hmm. They're skeptical of institutions. They've been shaped by phones and social media. They're characterized by anxiety and depression. But do you see some hopeful signs of this generation? Are there some encouraging characteristics you found in your research related to Gen Z?
I think they still have, they want to believe. If you look at the data, like that's the thing that people like, so we talk about great dechurching, all these people left church and all these things. But if you actually like drill down below the behavior piece and look at the belief piece, 90% of Americans still believe in God at some level, depending on how you ask the question. I mean, we still have a seed of spiritual hunger inside of us. Mm-hmm. And I do think there's a thread running through the younger generation where they want to try to return to some of the institutions and structures and rhythms that the older generation had. Maybe the baby boomers, the greatest generation, realizing that what we lost with them, some of it was good, right? The racism, misogyny, sexism, all those things are good. But the rhythm of life is something that they don't have and they want to try to return to.
Right.
I actually think if you see some of the kind of churches that are growing, it's they're adding pieces of the liturgy back.
Yes.
Like things like the creed, things like the readings, things like the lectionary, you know, those little things like that. It's like, let's give you some sort of structure in your life, like a skeleton that you can hang, a scaffolding that can give you meaning and purpose. And I think that's what Gen Z is missing, because if you got to think about, they went through COVID, and COVID basically took every social structure around and destroyed all of it, saying, you don't have to go to class anymore. You don't have to go to work anymore. You don't have to, you know, the government's going to give you all this money to stay home and not go to work. And people are like, wait a minute, we're still recovering from that. I think bringing people back to that structure and saying, okay, the reason your parents and grandparents got through their lives is because they had this rhythm. Let's return to that rhythm. I think churches that can really be consistent, right? You know what you're getting when you come to church. It's going to be this long. It's going to have this part. You're going to not like this part, but you're going to like this part. You know, like you know what you're getting into. Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of Gen Z people where everything feels like shifting sand, to have one or two consistent pieces a week is so incredibly valuable for them, because time has become so much more malleable. And, you know, it's not like Monday. I go to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 9 to 5 anymore. It's like, oh, I go a little bit on Monday and a little bit on Thursday. Like having church at 9:30 every Sunday morning is like, that's consistent. That's a tent peg. It doesn't move. And I think a lot of Gen Z really want that consistency, at least a little bit in one aspect of their lives.
Yes, that's encouraging. I wanted to end just with a question, more personal. You're really interesting because you're an educator, you're a data scientist, and you're a Sunday pastor.
I am.
So these are different dimensions, but what is a common thread for you that might run through those various dimensions of identity?
Yeah, I think it's the idea that we're all part of a larger story. You know, I've always been sort of obsessed with this idea of, you know, I am a drop in the ocean, but the waves are moving in a certain direction. Like I was born in a milieu, right? Like things are and you know, what really tipped me off was I read a book by Malcolm Gladwell, who I'm not a huge fan of, but I think this book was really smart when he talks about Michael Dell, Steve Jobs, and Bill Gates all were born within the same like 18-month period of time and all had access to computers before almost anyone else because of a bunch of happenstance reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? They all, you know, really changed the future, right? Changed all humanity because they were the right person born the right time. And I think that's something I'm always thinking about in terms of religion. Like when was I born versus Billy Graham, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. Billy Graham was in his late 30s when the baby boom happened. So he'd gotten enough seasoning as a preacher and he was working into an environment where religion was, you know, acceptable and there were babies being born and families were wanting to find a church. It's like if Billy Graham was born in 1970 instead of 1915, would he be as successful as he is? Trying to understand those questions really drives me. So understanding my own story, like when I grew up in American evangelicals in the 1990s. You know, like what does that tell me about who I am and what I believe? Putting me in the larger context, I think, is so incredibly important. And I think when you do that for people, it's almost like a superpower. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, okay, I understand where my story fits into the larger story. And I understand why I feel this way and why I believe this way and why these things are happening around me. And to get really personal, every church that I've been on staff of is either dramatically smaller today than it was when I was there or closed down. And why is that? You know, is it because I'm a bad preacher? Might be, possibly. But also could be we're in a different space of religion. And helping me understand that larger meta-narrative gives me less anxiety about my own performance. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not all me. It's not none of me either. But what's happening around me is probably more important than what's happening in my specific story. And nestling myself in the larger narrative, I think, is just such a comforting way to go through life. Because you realize what's happening to you is not always your fault. And all the success you get is not always your doing. It's part of this bigger story.
Ryan Burge, thank you for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This is Asbury. To learn more about Asbury University, visit asbury.edu.